This is the Behind the Batch podcast with me, Daniel Freeman.
And me, James Roberts. Each episode we'll be chatting Oxford United with the names of yesteryear.
Whether it be a former player, manager or chairman, our aim will be to listen to their story.
Behind the Badge is an unofficial podcast that digs deep into the highs and lows of Oxford United's history. We hope you enjoy it.
Well, Behind the Badge is on the road again, and this time we've come to South Oxfordshire, Dorchester-on-Thames, and we're speaking to United's former youth development officer for a long period of time. Many fantastic United players coming through the ranks at that time, and it's Malcolm Elias. Malcolm, thank you for doing this. We really appreciate it.
That's my pleasure.
Malcolm, tell us how it all began at United, because before you were at the club, you were a PE teacher in Oxford. So how did the two things sort of come together?
It was quite bizarre, really, because my headmaster, Bob Moon, and the chief education officer, Tim Brighouse, were both United season ticket holders. They were both very frustrated at the lack of activity at youth level at the club. They lost the likes of Martin Keown, Gary Parker. So they had a brainwave which I wasn't aware of. I was summoned to Macclesfield House. I had no idea what for. And I was told by Tim and Bob that I was going on a year's secondment, which they would pay for, that they had confirmed with Maxwell and the manager at Oxford United. And I was going to go in there to create a club-school partnership. So it ended up, or started, as a one-year secondment. After about 3 months, United said I was staying, and I dillied and dallied because football was so insecure compared to teaching at the time.
Because you would have seen already, having had at Pierce School the likes of Mark Wright, Mark Jones, I'm sure you could tell me some other names that went on to United and either stayed there and had careers there or even moved on, like Mark Wright did, on to play for Derby and Liverpool and England.
Absolutely. I obviously knew the local scene because I was a PE teacher. I knew all the local teachers. So in some respects, what opportunity I was given, I was probably well prepared for, because I had the contacts in all the schools, not just in the city but in the county.
Take us back just before we move on to Malcolm as the PE teacher then. What would you say you were like? Was it disciplinarian like, or was it more looking out for the kids in another way?
I think I was very fortunate. I worked with a gentleman called Lynn Evans, and he ran a very strict department. We were in a good school, good catchment area in terms of sportsmen. The youngsters at the school loved sport. So if you were going to be a teacher at Pierce School at the time, sport was the thing to be involved with. And as you say, you know, we had the likes of Mark Wright, Mark Jones, Chrissy Allen was another one of our boys. So no, I was lucky, I think, to have my first job there.
Take us through then to your sort of first days at Oxford United, first impressions, because it sounds like you hadn't worked in football before. Going into a club that I think was still in the top division, you know, what was it like going through the door there?
It was different. When I went in there, I didn't have an office. I wasn't quite sure what I was going to be doing. But as I was as a teacher, I was very fortunate because Maurice Evans was effectively director of football. He'd been manager. He'd been manager of a couple of clubs, including Reading. And Maurice was vastly experienced. You know, the players that he signed for Oxford United, the Aldridges, the Houghtons, the Saunderses. So I was very fortunate that Maurice took me under his wing a little bit. So things that might have taken me 5 years to learn, I probably learned in a month, just by going, watching games with him. And Maurice was a stickler. He would say to you, when we get to the game, I don't want you to talk to me about the game, and I won't talk to you. And then when we got in the car afterwards, he'd quiz me on my thoughts and then he'd give me his thoughts. So it was a learning curve, and I learned from probably one of the best.
Did you find, you know, when you were comparing notes afterwards, that you were agreeing on stuff, you were disagreeing? Was it best to kind of sort of be looking at football the same way, or was it kind of a benefit that you were sort of coming from different backgrounds in a way?
I would give my honest opinion, and then Morris might give me his opinion, and they may well differ. And many times I reflected on it and thought, yeah, perhaps I missed that. But I wasn't the only one at Oxford United to benefit from Morris's experience, expertise. Steve McLaren, who became England manager, we appointed Steve as youth team coach because Brian Horton wanted him off the wage bill on the playing side of the club because Steve was always injured. And Brian used to say to me, McLaren's always reading books. He said, we've got a vacancy. You could take him off my hands and he could become youth team coach. And that was fantastic for me as well, because in my office in the morning, because eventually I got an office, in the morning before training, Steve would come in with a sheet of paper and like a lesson plan. And Morris would take the sheet of paper. He wouldn't say a word. And Morris and I would go down to training. We'd watch the session. Morris would say nothing. We'd come back to my office, cup of tea, maybe a sandwich, and then Morris would, if you like, discuss the session with Steve. He'd discuss the positives of the session and maybe a couple of negatives. And then tomorrow would be based on what Morris had said to Steve. So Steve would try and correct what Morris thought were things that could have been better. So it was fascinating for me because, you know, one man had been a manager in the Premier League or the top league, and the other man was going to manage England and is still assistant manager of Manchester United. So, you know, my learning curve, I was so fortunate.
Was it always like he was going to go on to reach those heights then? Was he one of those that you could see, even as a player, this guy's going to have a successful career in coaching?
Steve was meticulous. He was well organised as a person. We used to go every Tuesday, the first team, to one of the local schools, be it Oxford School, Edmund Campion, Charwell, Piers, and we used to take the first team group because the first team had nowhere to train. So because of my links with local schools, we used to go to a school, put a session on, the kids of the school would watch, and the players would stay behind afterwards on a selected basis to coach young players. And McLaren, I remember Steve and Mark Steen, they were fantastic. I'd have to say that they probably were the best double act of all the players. And to be fair to the players, they were excellent at the time. Because I remember the first time we went to a school, they were thinking the pitch would be not very good. But there was a gentleman called Ken Ridley who eventually went to work at Oxford United. Ken was in charge of the grounds at schools, so Ken used to make sure that every Monday his men would be wherever Oxford United were going on Tuesday, and he would prepare the pitch to ensure that the players had no complaints, because at that time we had Saunders, Houghton, Aldridge, you know, top players. So the last thing the manager wanted was them complaining about the playing surface. So my connections were quite helpful at the time.
But Robbie Musto must have been one of the first ones to come through and then sort of move on to bigger and better things. Could you sense with him, say, for instance, that there was a big career in the offing there?
Yeah, Robbie, you know, similarly Kevin Brock, you know, these boys were top players, good people, you know, solid, reliable, and just probably needed that opportunity. And they had the ability to take it. You know, they were fortunate. They came through at a time when clubs looked at local players more than perhaps they do now. Players didn't even used to move at the time. People were loyal, if you like, to their local community, their local club. Things have obviously changed a lot now. You get young players moving at the age of 12, you know, moving to the other side of the country. No, Kevin and Robbie were top players.
That was the early days. I mean, do you remember many that stick in your mind that you had and then went elsewhere? The club lost out on them and then they went on before they had the chance to come through the United ranks, or did it just not happen as much back then?
I don't think it happened as much. You know, Chrissy eventually went, Joey eventually went, Bobby Ford went, you know, Simon Marsh went. But I think that there is a time when a player needs to move on. I think if you're not careful, you get stale maybe. You know, I've been fortunate in my career that the likes of Gareth Bale, Theo Walcott, Oxlade-Chamberlain, Luke Shaw, you know, they all moved on, and it was probably right for them to move on. You know, and I think that sometimes you're pleased to have played a part, however small that is, to give them the opportunity.
As we sort of go chronologically through, sort of in the sort of turn of the 80s into the 90s, it's obviously quite a turbulent time at the club with the ownership and everything going on sort of way above you. What do you remember, and what you probably had to, did you feel you had to deal with anything, or was there other people, were you allowed to get on with your job in developing the younger players coming through?
I think we were fortunate because Unipart was such fantastic sponsors, and particularly of youth development. You know, they were very supportive. They knew the financial condition the club was or wasn't in. You know, they would support us wholeheartedly. So we had that buffer, if you like. And plus the fact that when I started, there was just me. There was nobody else. Peter Rose Brown, who unfortunately his career finished through injury, we started him on as a community officer, and then football in the community took off. So Peter became an employee of the Football in the Community program. And then Mark Jones and Liz Taylor, I was lucky to be able to bring them in, but I had to guarantee that we could pay their wages. And I say we, the Youth Development Department. So we ran soccer courses, which Mark and Les ran. We had teachers that came and helped coach on them. And, you know, we covered their wages because that was the only way we could do it. That was the only way the club could sanction it, because obviously they didn't have the money to pay extra staff. But what that allowed me to do was to, if you like, more impetus on our youth program, because Les and Mark were obviously, and Peter, you know, were well established in the football community in Oxford, or were well respected as players and people. So from being a band of one, I became a band of four. And, you know, the good thing was that, you know, we had four full-time people. And although their jobs weren't just about helping and producing and developing players, you know, they were integral into what I ultimately wanted to achieve.
Yeah, and obviously you mentioned about the work going to schools, and, you know, I gather through your contacts within the sort of schools in Oxfordshire, you know, you could sort of speak to a lot of young kids and know, you know, keep an eye on who was going to be the ones that might to keep an eye on. Was that sort of a big part of the job, or were there sort of other aspects to the sort of youth development aspect that you were doing day to day?
No, I think the soccer courses were massive, because apart from anything else, raising money to, if you like, employ Mark, Peter and Les, it was also insightful in terms of recruiting players. Because, you know, on these courses, lots of youngsters would come, you know, because they wanted to get into Oxford United's youth programme. And similarly, we used to run a tournament for Unipart indoors at Blackwood Lees. And the amount of teams that used to come from everywhere, you know, when you look at some of the players that we signed, like we spoke earlier about Simon Weatherston from Woodkit, you know, most of these young players were seen either at a Unipart tournament on our soccer courses, because at the time, you know, we had very few scouts in terms of people employed by Oxford United. I was fortunate that I had eyes and ears in terms of PE teachers at schools who would ring me up and say, I've got so and so. And also at that stage, schools football was very strong. You know, the Oxford boys got to the English Schools Trophy final a couple of times, which probably reflected the strength of football in Oxford at the time. You know, I now go and speak to people, teachers who are, you know, still working, and schools football is dead. It really is. It's so sad, you know. And I think football clubs have a major role to play in schools football, because otherwise, you know, lots of these youngsters are not going to get the opportunities that once were there.
Is it because clubs are sort of sweeping up kids so young and getting them in their academies? Is that the reason?
Yeah, and I can understand why, you know, they get players in early, because the more time you can spend with them, in theory, the better they should be, you know. Clubs have development centres now where youngsters come as young as five. You know, and in London, for example, because I'm at Fulham now, in London it is so competitive with Chelsea, Arsenal, Tottenham, West Ham, Fulham, you know, because what will happen is clubs will have these development centres for 5 to 9 year olds. Say, for example, Palace will have theirs on a Monday, Fulham on a Tuesday, Arsenal Wednesday, and some youngsters might go to 5 development centres, 5 different clubs in a week. Now, obviously, it's a bit different around here. You know, you've really just got Oxford United in the county. So, you know, Oxford United should have the best players in the county, particularly at the younger age groups. And I'd have to say that I've seen a massive improvement, without being disrespectful, at Oxford United recently with regards to young players. And, you know, it's nice to see a couple of young players now beginning to make a mark in the first team, because when I was doing it, automatically players came to their local club. So, you know, we always had players in the team, be it Joey Beecham, be it Chrissy Allen, be it Jamie Brooks, be it, you know, whoever. We always had those local players, Chrissy Hackett, Sam Ricketts, Dean Whitehead, you know, whereas recently it's become a bit threadbare, but hopefully now Oxford United have turned the corner again.
Didn't think it was going to be long before we mentioned Joey, because when you think of a local boy playing for Oxford United, he's the first one that comes to mind. He would have obviously already been in the club as part of the youth setup, I imagine, when you arrived. How old was he? When did you first sort of become aware of him?
I used to take the Oxford boys, which is a select team of the Oxford schools. And by the Oxford schools, I mean the City of Oxford schools. Joey was one of my Oxford boys at under 14. He was always a precocious talent, you know. I wouldn't say he was a one-man team, because that's disrespectful to the others, but, you know, Joey had that something special. Always had that something special. He just could do things that other players couldn't do. And, you know, he used to just love turning up on a Saturday morning and watching him play. And I became quite close with Joey. I was left with the poison chalice of getting him to go to Swindon. I never forget that day. I kept saying to him as I drove him there, are you sure you know what you're doing? Because Oxford United obviously were relying on the money from West Ham. It didn't happen. And I remember Keith Cox, the managing director, saying, "You're not going to like this, but we're going to have to sell Joey Beecham, and Swindon are the only takers at the money we need." And I remember saying to John Gorman, because John was manager at Swindon, because Glenn Hoddle had left, I remember saying to John, "John, this is hell of a gamble for you, because he's an Oxford player and there's no love lost between the clubs. And it's a big, big moment for Joey in particular, because he's going to get some stick, because he's an Oxford boy." And by the time we left there that day, Joey had, I'll say reluctantly, I think Joey put the club before he put himself. I think he realised that for the club to survive, he had to go to Swindon.
With Joey, when did you, when were you aware of his demons, as it were, in terms of the you know, the issues he had with gambling and that sort of stuff? Was it something that you, someone had sort of spotted early doors, or was it only later on?
No, when I was there, you know, these things weren't common knowledge. I think it was after I'd left. And unfortunately, in those days, perhaps there wasn't the support for players that had issues. You know, these days now, there's so much support for players in different ways. I'm not saying that it wouldn't have happened, but I think at least there would have been some help for him.
I mean, look at the work that you did with Southampton in the way that, and I remember, and I've heard it time and time again, how the sort of players that came through, Gareth Bale, Theo Walcott, Adam Lallana, James Ward-Prowse, the list goes on. The key thing with these people were that they were good, sort of good people first, as well as good professionals, good footballers. Was that something that you tried to throughout your career, tried to, you know, get right in the first instance, that if the player has got, you know, right in the head and they're a good person, they're a polite person, they know how to speak to people, then the ability will shine through?
Yeah, I think my teaching background and the fact that I worked with Lynn Evans taught me early doors that, you know, standards, behaviour, you know, were very, very important. And of all the boys that you've mentioned, you know, the Walcotts and the Bales, the Luke Shaws, you know, all these kids had one thing in common. They were good people, came from good families. You know, the Bale family was so supportive, because it took us a long time to give Gareth a scholarship. You know, when I was at Liverpool, I was lucky enough to work with Trent Alexander-Arnold, and Trent's mum, you know, there's no way that Trent Alexander-Arnold is going to be a bad person, because his mum just wouldn't let it happen. And I think these are key factors for any young player. And I think increasingly so, because there's so many temptations now for young players and old players, but certainly young players. And I think that's where the game's improved, that there's so much more support. And whilst agents get a bit of stick, most agents now have support mechanisms for their players in terms of investing money, for example. You know, in Joey's time, those things didn't exist. You know, you had to find out yourself. And, you know, sometimes, as in Joey's case, it went wrong.
I mean, there was problems at the turn of the 80s to 90s in terms of what was going on the pitch, off the pitch with the Maxwells, get towards the end of the 90s, and then the club's in greater problems in terms of potentially going bust. There was people not getting paid, members of staff and so forth. But one shining light was the players that were coming through the youth system, in the likes of Paul Powell, Jamie Cook, the Weatherstone brothers, Sam Ricketts, John Shepherd. You know, at one stage, there was a lot of young players. You know, Mike Ford became manager at one stage, and he was fielding even more. Jamie Brooks, you've mentioned. And you were also on the move as well. But obviously, you felt as if you were leaving at a time when you got the club in the youth development programme in such a strong place?
Well, I remember having a conversation with Malcolm Shotton. Malcolm had just become manager, and he and Keith Cox, who was managing director, I think it was probably one of my last games, and I remember saying, listen, you've got some terrific young players coming through here. And some of the ones you mentioned, you know, Sam Ricketts springs to mind at the time, Dean Whitehead, Chrissy Hackett, all these types of boys. So yeah, you know, we were very fortunate in that we had an established programme. We had good staff in the likes of Peter, Les, Mark and many others. And we had a good programme. And we were well supported by Unipart. And kids got a chance then. You know, it was, I wouldn't say it was easier. You still had to be good enough. But there wasn't the transfer fees that are going around at the moment. Kids weren't travelling from one side of the country to the other. The Man Cities weren't about at the time. So in some respects it was easier. You still had to develop the players, but you could argue it was easier.
Just on that group of players, you know, a lot of them went on to have successful careers playing, but also coaching as well. You know, Dean Whitehead, I think, is at Cardiff. Simon Weatherstone at Newcastle after Bournemouth. Sam Ricketts has been an EFL manager as well. Is that something that you could see? Is that something that you think is installed in someone young enough when they're in a sort of a teenage player that maybe those leadership qualities might come through later on?
In some cases, yes. Some people surprise you. You know, I've worked with a lot of managers. You know, Steve McLaren managed England. Probably too early in his managerial career, some would suggest. You know, at Oxford United, I was lucky enough. I started with Mark Lawrenson, who was a very, very thoughtful manager. He managed like he played. Brian Horton, who's a very good friend of mine. You know, Brian had his own way. You know, Brian would, I wouldn't say frighten the players, but they knew where they stood. You know, and then you had Dennis Smith, you know, and Dennis is a good guy. And he had Malcolm Crosby as his assistant, you know, so, and there is a team within a team, if you like, because Brian Horton had David Moss, and I took David, ironically, with me to Southampton and Liverpool to work on the recruitment side. And I think, as you mentioned earlier, you have a good cop and a bad cop. You know, Brian Horton and Mark Lawrenson were a perfect combination. Brian Horton and David Moss were a perfect combination. Dennis Smith, Malcolm Crosby, perfect combination. You know, when I went to Fulham, there was Roy Hodgson and Ray Lewington. You know, great combination. And it is about these combinations, not just on the pitch, off the pitch. And you can see why managers tend to take their number twos with them, because they can trust them. The number twos know how they think. They know how they work. And yeah, it's been really interesting. You know, I was lucky enough to work with Glenn Hoddle at Southampton. And, you know, Glenn was so intelligent, not just as a player, but as a coach, as a manager.
Just before we move on properly to your sort of post-Oxford career, because obviously there was so much that happened after that, I did want to ask about one more player who I think you mentioned, which was Jamie Brooks, who could have been one of the, you know, great products, I guess, of Oxford United, and sort of had it robbed from him by illness. You obviously would have been there, I guess, from the start of his time with the club. How highly thought of, what was he, what could he have been?
We wanted to sign him at Southampton. I turned up for a pre-season friendly, Oxford City versus Oxford United. Jamie was probably 17 at the time. And as I walked in, I saw Steve Rowley, who was the main man at Arsenal, and Eddie Nedvisky. And I thought to myself, there's only one person they've come to see, And as it transpired, he was going to Arsenal. And then obviously they discovered this illness, and the rest is history. You know, would Jamie Brooks have been Oxford United's best player ever? You know, you can't answer that. But he certainly had the potential as a young player to be, you know, one of Oxford's best. And I include, you know, the likes of Aldridge, Houghton, Saunders, and Joey himself. But Jamie Brooks was a special talent, no question about that.
There's one that wasn't too far behind, and equally injuries hampered him at a time as well, and that was Paul Powell. And I'd love you to just go back over your sort of early memories of Powley, and maybe in comparison to someone like Dean Whitehead.
Paul Powell was a terrific player. If I was picking my all-time United team, he'd definitely be in that. And when I think that I was fortunate enough to be involved with Luke Shaw, you know, at similar ages, Paul Powell was at the same level. You know, now Luke Shaw has gone on to great things. But Paul Powell had everything, and I don't think he'd be too pleased to hear me say this, but he knows himself that perhaps he didn't take it seriously enough, that he had all the tools. But, you know, when you look at Dean Whitehead, similar era, Dino had good ability, nowhere near what Powley had. Didn't have Powley's pace, ability to beat people, but Dino had a fantastic mentality. He was a winner. Whatever Dean Whitehead did, he was a winner. And a consummate professional. And it was really interesting at Shrewsbury when Dino teamed up with Sam Ricketts, you know, two really solid people, solid characters, gave everything to whatever they did. Whereas Powley, some days you'd think that, you know, he could beat anybody, and other days he'd go missing a little bit. And listen, he's a smashing person, Paul. I don't think he realised what he had, unfortunately. But once again, you know, he was another real top talent.
Was it Southampton after United, or was it Swansea, Malcolm?
I went to Swansea they were promised a new stadium, and the person who took me in there, Steve Hamer, who's a big friend of Jeremy Charles's, because Jeremy also joined us on the youth development side. I went to Swansea and was told that we'd have a new stadium within 2 years. So I left Oxford probably the right time. I turned down quite a few opportunities, but Swansea was too big to turn down for me, because I lived about 10 miles from there. I was born 10 miles from there, and I had some good friends there on the staff, the likes of Alan Curtis. I took Jeremy Charles down there with me. Unfortunately, the council, in their wisdom or lack of it, did a U-turn, and the stadium didn't happen. And I had a gentleman's agreement with Steve Hamer, the chairman, that if it didn't happen, then I could leave. And fortunately, I had an offer from Southampton, and I left at the end of my second season. And once again, I was lucky that I worked with a top-class person. He sadly died recently, John Hollins. John was manager at Swansea, and I learned a lot from John.
Because that's when you went to Southampton, it was almost business was business, because I'm of the generation that remember all of a sudden a few of the up-and-coming stars at Oxford United, and quite young as well, ended up going the way of Southampton. And obviously you had your ear to the ground, and you still had your contacts, and you knew maybe where the better players from this area, albeit it's only an hour away from Southampton, could make that transition?
Yeah, obviously I knew Dexter really well. In fact, a school teacher friend of mine who taught at Temple Cowley, John Searle, he used to run the primary schools team, and virtually every Saturday morning he used to have to go and wake Dexter up, because Dexter would, getting up wasn't one of his strengths. And when he turned up, that was his strength. So I knew him as a young boy. You know, he came from Blackburn Leeds, the same as Brooksy. You know, and at the same time, we had a young boy called Gareth McCleary, who's had a good career, still playing at Wycombe Wanderers. So I did come back to Oxford. Dexter obviously worked. And he was one of the first that I brought to Southampton. Ironically, Leon Best was another who had a good career, and probably the one who's had the longest career, David McGoldrick, who is now still playing at the club I took him from. I took him from Notts County and he's gone back there, which is a great story. But we signed those very quickly, Dexter, Leon and David. And then we signed Theo Walcott for the mighty fee of £2,000. And I was delighted, as it was from Swindon. We signed Adam Lallana for £2,000 from Bournemouth. So when I went into Southampton, the chairman was massively supportive. And we invested. We probably started something which now is commonplace. We went to the lower leagues. And we took young players from the lower leagues. And that's how it all started. And then, you know, we had boys like Luke Shaw, who ironically lived about 3 miles from my current club, Fulham's training ground. And then we had Andrew Sermon, who must have played 300-400 league games. So we had a combination of players that we brought in. And then you look at Portsmouth. We took James Ward-Prowse from Portsmouth. We took Harrison Reid, who's now playing in Fulham's first team. We took Callum Chambers, who's playing in the Premier League, went to Arsenal. Because I remember Steve Rowley saying to me one day, and he was Arsene Wenger's top man, he came to watch Callum Chambers one day and Fulham were playing Southampton. And he said to me, we're spending all this money buying young players from Southampton, like Oxlade-Chamberlain, Theo Walcott, Callum Chambers. He said, why didn't we employ you in the first place? And I laughed. I said, it's a bit late now.
Just the names rolled off the tongue, though, Malcolm. And, you know, it was all groundwork, because there was a period at Southampton when Pochettino was manager, when Nigel Adkins, and obviously, because, you know, there were people before them that sort of took the club back, having dropped into League One at one stage. And then it was just like a constant conveyor belt of players that just kept on popping up, and they were all coming through the youth development system.
It's ironic that Southampton have got this reputation, and still have this reputation, as a club that's developed young players. And ironically, I don't think there's too many young players that actually have achieved regular first team football at Southampton since Steve Wigley, Hugh Jennings and myself left. Because Ward-Prowse, who's probably the last one, you know, he was an under nine when we were there.
When I was doing a bit of research, reading up on you before this, I saw one article describe you as a super scout, and the players that, you know, we've just been speaking about there suggest that, because, you know, that's no accident, is it? And I guess it shows you're standing within the game, because after Southampton, it was Liverpool that came calling then, is that right?
I had an offer to go to Chelsea, and I spoke to Chelsea with Southampton's knowledge, and to be honest, I wasn't really tempted, because it didn't fit what I was looking to move on to if I was going to move on. The irony is that they asked me to bring somebody in with me, Chelsea, and the best person was a lad called Jim Fraser, and he was the head recruiter at Swindon. And I obviously knew Jim well because we competed with each other, and Jim Fraser's now the main man at Chelsea in terms of recruitment. So although I didn't go to Chelsea, I think they got the best part of the deal, I think, in Jim Fraser. But when I turned Chelsea down, I think everybody thought I was mad. What an opportunity. And who knows, you know, I talked to Jim now, and, you know, it's a shame we never got to work together. But I ended up 12 months later having an offer from Liverpool, from Steve Highway and Rick Parry. And, you know, I didn't have any second thoughts. I thought Liverpool's the right fit for what I wanted if I was going to leave Southampton. Because although Southampton had been relegated to League One, you know, we still had a fantastic setup. We had fantastic young players. We also had that reputation that would encourage others to come.
Also, I think I'm right that Chelsea at that time didn't really have a reputation of giving young players opportunities as well and bringing them through, and maybe Liverpool did. Is that fair? Was that part of it?
I think the thing at Chelsea was that they realised that they needed to do something. And at the time at Southampton, if you like, we were ahead of the game without being arrogant. We were ahead of the game, both on and off the pitch, in terms of recruitment, in terms of the coaching. But when I went to speak to Steve Highway and Rick Parry, I just got a different feel. And I had no hesitation in accepting their offer. It was a bit unfortunate in the end, because Rick Parry and Steve Highway fell out with Rafa Benitez. Benitez managed to get rid of both of them, and my loyalty was to Steve Highway and Rick Parry. So I remember having the conversation with Benitez as number two, and saying, listen, you know, it's time for me to go. But I already knew that I had a job waiting at Fulham, because Fulham wanted to, if you like, catch up, move on in terms of young players. And when I met Mr. Al-Fayed at the time with the chief executive, you know, he made it clear that he wasn't spending any more big money on players that the academy had to produce. So although I didn't particularly want to leave Liverpool, I thought, listen, this is a good option. And 14 years later, I'm still there, and we think we've got some excellent young players. So it's a good club. It was a good decision. And I don't regret leaving Liverpool. Who knows what might have happened or not happened. I'm fortunate that Trent Alexander-Arnold, although he's a young boy at the time, the coaches didn't want to sign him because his mum was an Evertonian. It was a ridiculous scenario. But the chap who brought Trent into the club, Ian Barrigan, he persuaded me to stick with Trent and his mum. And the irony is, I'm still in touch with Trent and his mum, Diane. And when I let them know I was leaving, because I was quite close with them, I gave him as a leaving present signed shirts from Theo Walcott and Gareth Bale. And my challenge to him was, will you ever play against these two players? And the irony is, he played against Gareth Bale in the Champions League final. Unbelievable.
What a moment that is, and literally up against each other, I guess, with Bale on the left and Trent the right back.
Absolutely unbelievable. You know, when you think two young players that I'd had, you know, quite a bit to do with, and still with Trent, you know, I still text him regularly, he texts back, texts his mum regularly, because obviously with England he's had a tough time. And I think one of people say, what do you think his strengths are? I think Harry Redknapp kindly in his book, when he was manager at Tottenham, he gave me credit for Gareth Bale, because when Gareth had gone 25 games, I think, without being on the pitch when Tottenham won, I used to message Gareth regularly, speak to his parents regularly, and Harry used to say to me, you know, he said, you keep his chin up. He said, I'm knocking it down and you're picking it up. And I think, you know when a player needs your help. You know, Gareth Bale, when he became the player that he is, you know, at Tottenham and then Real Madrid, he didn't need Marcus Milius. He didn't need anyone. But there are times when, you know, even players who become the top players, there's moments of doubt. And it's the same in life. You know, people do doubt themselves. You know, I sometimes doubt myself when I make a decision to sign a player. You think to yourself, did I get that one right? And you're never going to get them all right. Of course you're not. You know, but no, it's interesting to see how and when players develop. Because with Mark Wright, similar to Gareth Bale, nobody fancied Mark Wright. When I was a teacher at Pierce School, there was no interest in him. And then all of a sudden, he developed physically. And at 18, goodness me, you know, you could see a real player. And Gareth Bale the same. If you'd have seen Gareth Bale at 15, you'd never have said he'd have had the career he's going to have, or has had. So, you know, sometimes you have to be extra patient, you know, and not give up on players. It's the same as when players join a new club. You know, it doesn't matter how good they are, sometimes you have to be patient with them, you know. And I laugh when I hear managers saying about loan players. They always say, the problem with a loan player is, when he's on loan, he's not under pressure. If you then sign him, all of a sudden he's your player, and there's different pressures. And you know, so often you see players sign after a loan spell, and for some reason it's not the same.
Do you think, just since your days at Oxford and when you first came into football, the game has got better at being patient with players? Because there's so many stories of, like, down the years where players maybe got released from certain clubs because they at 15 they hadn't developed physically, but then at 16 had a growth spurt or something like that. Has the game got better at sort of the whole product of the footballer, rather than just looking at a player for at age 16, for example, what they can do on the pitch? Has it got better at seeing what they could become as well?
I think there's a lot of positives to be said for academies in terms of categories 1, 2, 3. Compared to when they were centres of excellence. There's obviously massive investment now in all academies, but particularly Category 1 academies. You know, it's astonishing the amount of support mechanisms that, for example, me in recruitment have now, in terms of, you know, every day I get stats on our full-time players. You know, how much ground they've covered, their intensity. Similarly on a match day. And similarly, if you look into, shall we say, take a player, you can get all the stats in the world. You know, you get things like predicted height, you know, where he is in his maturation. Because, you know, when I started, that was guesswork. You know, you look at mum and dad and you think, right, mum's a tall lady, so he's going to be a tall boy. And it was guesswork. Whereas now, you know, they can do it down to the smallest fraction. And similarly in training, you know, there's no hiding place, because these stats, they now record every day. They'll have it on an individual player's chart. If I bring a trialist in, you know, straight away he'll have a pod on and you'll be able to see what yardage he's covered, how quick he is, you know. and these types of things, which do make a massive difference in the equation. Because you can go and watch a player, and he might play against not a very average player on the day. But if you've got these stats, and I remember at Southampton, you know, we used to compare the boys we had even in net those days. Like when Theo Walcott played in the first team, to begin with, his high intensity runs were the best in that league, because you can compare and contrast. The same now, if we get boys who go away with England, for example, and play in the youth teams, we can compare our player with the best young players in the country. And similarly, if I'm looking to buy a Dexter Blackstock now, I can get all the information on Dexter Blackstock that I want. So, you know, the game has changed in that respect. I still believe it's about your own eyes, you know, what you can see, what you can envisage in the future. But now the support mechanisms. I go up to Horsepath Road regularly to watch Oxford's younger teams, obviously looking for players for Fulham. But at the same time, I'm also interested to see the way that Oxford United are and have developed their own programme. People will say, well, they're Category 3. They're Category 3, I think, in name only, to be fair to them. And that comes down to investment. Because if you want to become a Category 1 club, you know, there's massive investment. It's like when we had to reapply for our Category 1 status, we didn't have the required indoor area. We didn't have a floodlit artificial. So our chairman invested about £10 million in getting an indoor facility and also a new Astro with floodlights. So, you know, to be at the top end in terms of facilities is a massive investment. But what Oxford United have got now, we never had it. We used to go to schools, as I said earlier. We'd beg, steal and borrow. We'd go up to Cutslow Park. We'd have to put the nets up ourselves, you know. But those days have changed and moved on. And I have to say that Oxford United, there's a significant, I think, improvement at youth level now. And I can see that the club will start again producing, you know, young players. And don't get me wrong, I don't think there's anything wrong with what our staff went through, putting up nets and things. Because when I was at Liverpool, and I laugh now, we had a close relationship with Wrexham. Rick Parry was very friendly with the owner at the time of Wrexham, Jeff Moss. And on a Sunday, I used to go and watch him play sometimes. And I'll never forget ringing my friend Hugh Jennings, who was with me at Southampton, and he'd gone to become head of the Premier League youth development when I went to Liverpool. And one day I'm at Wrexham's training ground, and I see somebody with a mower. He's pushing this mower up and down the field, and it was Stuart Webber, and we took him to Liverpool, and Stuart became sort of managing director in Norwich when they were in the Premier League. And he used to push a mower up at the training ground at Colliers Park. And there's a Premier League manager who's a very good friend of mine. I took him with Rick Parry's help from Wrexham to Liverpool, and he's now manager of Nottingham Forest, Steve Cooper. So Steve Cooper, I can still remember the days when he used to put the nets up on a Sunday morning. And, you know, he'll be the first to tell you, you know, they had nothing at the time. But, you know, you mucked in, you did those jobs. Rosie was the same, Les Taylor the same, Mark Jones the same. You know, and I'm sure lots of people's careers have been helped by having to do those things. Because the problem now is, if it is a problem, is everything's there. You know, you turn up at Horsepath Road on a Sunday morning, everything's ready. You turn up at Fulham's training ground, everything's ready. You know, somebody has to do it, don't get me wrong. But, you know, gone are the days where, you know, the head of recruitment or the head of coaching or the team coach, they used to do all these things. You know, when McLaren got sacked by England, I said, Steve, it's not quite as bad as that day when you're on the way to Exeter, you had no money and you ran out of petrol. You know, so, yeah, it's been an interesting part of my life, I think, since I left teaching.
Just one or two to finish, Malcolm, just going back to Oxford, because I know that you've recommended a couple of players to Oxford since you've left, probably more than a couple, and there's also been players from Fulham, I'm thinking Ryan Williams, and there was a left-back called Jordan, I can't remember his surname, Evans, that ended up coming to Oxford as well. So, obviously, A, you've remained in contact with the club quite closely, and B, keep an eye on them and we'll look after them almost as well.
Yeah, I'd like to think. There's a young boy called Casway now. He's a first-year boy, under 17. He came into Fulham. We didn't think that perhaps he was at the level. I have somebody in Oxford who works for me and with me. He was manager at Oxford City and Abingdon Town, Paul Lee. Paul recommended Casway to Oxford United. They took him. I recommended a boy called Nico Jones, who's now at Brentford. I recommended JJ.
Yeah, Johnson.
I think he's got a real chance if he applies himself to be a player. You know, so yeah, I'm very keen to help Oxford United because I was there a long time. You know, they're a special club to me. I'm very friendly with Neil McWilliams. I've been very impressed with Stevie Kinnebert since he's come in. I obviously know Chrissy Hackett really well. Chrissy Allen was there. So, you know, I have lots of connections at Oxford United. I enjoy going up there on weekends, not just to see the players. I still love going up there and have Les pour me a cup of tea or coffee. Sadly, Les is obviously retired and I wish him well. He's been a great servant to the club in lots of different ways. So no, I thoroughly enjoy going back up there. And what pleases me more is to see some young players now taking the opportunity. And let's hope, you know, there's more in the pipeline.
And just finally, the biggest news at the moment is obviously surrounding the stadium as well. And obviously it was very, go back to that word, turbulent again around the day's finishing at the Manor. The Kassam wasn't quite ready, I don't think, by the time you'd left.
Still isn't now.
Very good. You know, seeing these plans and hoping that they come to fruition for a new stadium in that sort of the arena that will be. How much do you think then, again, that makes someone else's job easier now that you had back then, like, you know, the dream being a reality?
Oh, listen, it'd be fantastic if it materialises. It looks a bit more positive now, which would be fantastic news for everybody who supports Oxford United and everybody who's involved with Oxford United, because it'll just give some momentum if it happens or when it happens. You know, you go to the training ground now and you can just see the building blocks. You can see that, you know, the club, in terms of their facilities, training facilities, are really going in the right direction. You know, I think it'd be nice if there was a bit more investment and perhaps an indoor area, so then they could maybe become a Category 2 club. Because there's lots of things that people maybe aren't aware of. Because if you're a Category 3 club, there's a set price for selling young players. If you're a Category 2 club, you get more money because there's more investment gone in. So there's lots of reasons why, you know, Oxford need to keep developing, not just at first team level. That's obviously massively important for supporters, for players, and for young players. But, you know, to continue to try and develop their own academy. Yeah, who knows? One day I might end up there.
Well, Malcolm, that seems like a good place to leave it. But yeah, thank you so much for your time today, and it's been fascinating to hear your thoughts on your time at Oxford United and all that went before and after it as well. So yeah, really appreciate that.
My pleasure. Come on, you Yellows.
Thank you for listening to Behind the Badge. Stay across our social media platforms for our next podcast.
You can follow us on Twitter at @behind_the_badge, or if you want to email us, it's behindthebadge1893@gmail.com.